Intelligent design and DNA. Scholars can't explain it all away. Get ready to be awed by the handiwork of God. Tune in to Real Science Radio. Turn up the Real Science Radio. Keeping it real.
Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. Welcome to Real Science Radio. I'm Bob Enyar, and this is our second interview with an engineer who was formerly with the U.S. Navy Nuclear Engineering Program, Jane Albright, about her article series on the global flood, and specifically looking at Dr. Walt Brown's hydroplate theory as it is compared to the vapor canopy theory and now catastrophic plate tectonics. So welcome back in studio, Jane Albright. Thank you for being here, Jane.
Thank you for having me, Bob.
So part three is all about catastrophic plate tectonics. And when we made a video on this, the global flood and the hydroplate theory, we tried our best to show people serious problems with catastrophic plate tectonics. Well, you take it on in your article series head on. Thank you for doing this.
Well, you're welcome, Bob. I certainly had a lot of help doing it. I extend a heartfelt thanks to Dr. John Baumgartner, who is CPT's primary author. He helped a lot. We traded several emails, and I had an opportunity to learn quite a bit about his theory and his work over the years, as well as ICR geologist and CPT advocate Dr. Tim Cleary, who also helped me understand ICR's position and some of the ideas that he has about CPT. So I thank them very much for their time.
And I've talked to both of these men, and I could confirm that your information is incredibly accurate and carefully done, Jane. So first you describe plate tectonics theory, because CPT, catastrophic plate tectonics, is a variation of the standard geological model.
True. That's what they teach in school. And so geologists today, that's what they study. That's the theory, plate tectonics. It's the dominant theory of today's secular geologists.
Now, many of us learned that the reason the plates move is because they're on like conveyor belts of convection currents in the mantle. Now that is no longer presented as the main model, because the mantle is like 99% or more solid rock.
Right.
So it's really hard to explain where these convection currents are going to make a conveyor belt.
Right. So the dominant theory right now, explanation for subduction, is something called slab pull, which says that the weight of the crust is what's actually falling down into the mantle below, and that's what's driving the tectonic
movement of the plates.
The movement of the plates, right.
Which is sort of like a chicken and egg problem, because, well, how does it start? If it's slab pull, because it's pulling into the mantle, well, how does that begin? There's no pull until it's going into the mantle. And sure enough, you get to that later in this article, but they have a really hard time explaining how subduction would initiate. But part of their model is that as the plates are moving, then rock melts.
Right.
It's called magma. And then that magma comes up through faults and it forms new ocean floor at the mid-oceanic ridge.
True. And then, so the magma comes up, it solidifies once it comes in contact with seawater, and then it spreads in opposite direction. And so you need that. It's like a mass balance. You need, if you're diving material down, it's got to be coming up somewhere else. Mm. Otherwise, you know, the Earth is not staying the same size. So the assumption is the Earth is staying the same size.
And you paraphrased one geologist that you interviewed who said, summing up plate tectonics, the ocean floors come and the ocean floors go. This is the bottom line of plate tectonics. And where they go is mostly into the trenches in the Pacific.
On the Pacific side.
According to the model.
According to the tectonic model, correct.
So then you get to catastrophic plate tectonics. You got to speed it up like a billion times to fit it into the history of the global flood. So how did we come about with catastrophic plate tectonics?
Well, quite a while ago, more than 20 years ago, Dr. Steve Austin, a geologist, and five other creationist scientists proposed a preliminary model of CPT. Again, you know, they're trained in plate tectonics, and they're saying, well, we know the Earth is young, so instead of these processes occurring over millions of years, they must have happened really quickly. Mm-hmm. And that was the catastrophe that gave rise to the global flood. So it's taken the theory and attempting to put it into the Bible.
And they believe that seafloor spreading and subduction are valid and that you can observe these today.
They're happening today, correct.
And hydroplate theory proponents challenge that and say, no, seafloor spreading is not happening. In fact, Walt Brown was friends with the man who coined the term seafloor spreading.
Yes, Dr. Bob Dietz. Dr. Brown met with him every Wednesday afternoon for several hours over the course of a year or so that he was studying at the University of Arizona, and they became quite good friends and sparring partners,
yeah.
Correct.
And so Walt is extremely up on the science of these issues and has just recently added to his website that after decades where the U.S. Navy kept classified information about the seafloor because it was part of our Trident nuclear defense, they've now gone public with that data. And one scientist with the Navy for decades has written two books, one in 2008, now in 2012, saying that plate tectonics is absolutely false, and it was developed when the authors of the theory knew almost nothing about the seafloor. And now that we know so much about the seafloor and it's been declassified, the theory should be scrapped.
Right. And his name is N. Christian, N as it's an initial, Christian Smoot. He spent over three decades with the Navy mapping the floor, and he was also instrumental in helping get that data declassified in the last decade or so.
And that's just tremendous that that is now available
right.
to researchers. Dr. John Baumgartner himself, he's quite an accomplished scientist. You point out he had a career at Los Alamos National Labs, and he truly is one of the best-known creation scientist because of his work in basic geology and computer science modeling of the interior of the Earth.
Right. He developed a computer software program called Terra, which is used widely by geologists all over the Earth for that kind of modeling mm-hmm. and exploration of behaviors under the Earth.
So if we could now go to what the supporters of catastrophic plate tectonics would say is support observational evidence that supports their theory.
Well, they would cite the relatively young age of the crust in under the oceans. So the seafloor, they would say that crust based on comparison of radiometric dating, they don't accept the absolute ages, but they say in a relative sense, you can see that it's young, it's youngest at the ridge and gets older as you go away.
In other words, if you do say potassium argon dating or some type of radiometric dating, when they take cores from the bottom of the ocean or they take rock from the mid-oceanic ridge, they look at the ocean and they say the radiometric dates are less than the radiometric dates of rock from the continents, even though they acknowledge that there's tremendous contradiction within the data of radiometric, that whole science. They do say that these give us relative dates. Like if you have something that's 100 million years old, allegedly, and something 20 million years old, the 20 million year old rocks will be younger than the 100 million year old rocks.
Right. That's one of their premises. Correct.
It's that reasoning that led John Baumgartner and a brilliant engineer creationist, Mark Horstemeyer, to say at a creation conference, I was shocked. In fact, the whole conference was shocked that they said that the moon was created before day four.
Right.
And that was really, it was startling. I don't know if they've retracted that. Do you know if they've retracted that?
I have not heard that they have.
And because they're making the same reasoning where they're saying, well, we look at the relative ages of the rocks on the moon, and so we think that the moon is older than the continental crust, and which is just, they admit that they don't understand the radiometric data. They don't know why it is as it is. And so then to take some data that you don't understand and build on that to say that the order of the creation events in Genesis 1 is not obvious, it's just dangerous. It's a mistake leading people astray.
One thing I've learned is how much our assumptions play into how we interpret data. Mm. And and how important it is to understand and to state those assumptions.
And thank you for that. And so that's one of their pieces of evidence. They say that the ocean crust looks younger than the continental crust.
Looks young. They'll also point to the last 45, 50 years of deep ocean drilling activity that's occurred, where we've gotten core samples from the ocean floor, and they've looked at that and assert that that supports the plate tectonic theory. So, and then they look at many physical aspects of the Earth and interpret them in light of plate tectonics,
like
the ridge.
Chains of volcanoes in the oceans.
Ocean trenches, the ridge itself.
Okay.
So they look at data, and as we all do, they look at it and interpret it.
Based on their model.
On their paradigm, correct.
Right. And so looking at CPT, looking at the hydroplate theory, then you could ask, is this data more consistent with the hydroplate theory or with CPT? And so that's the purpose of your article series. So they say, here's observational evidence of our model, but then here is computer simulation evidence of our model. And John Baumgartner, starting from when he was a college student, he's been developing software simulators to model the Earth.
Correct. And just sort of to summarize that, he states, by applying a trial and error approach to discover what initial conditions might yield a reasonable set of surface plate motions, what that means is he did a number of different programs and input different assumptions and variables to generate what he considers some plausible plate motion histories beginning from a single supercontinent. So he has a computer model into which he's input many assumptions.
Different starting conditions and assumptions, and trying to get something that would give you plate tectonics sped up a billion times.
Correct.
And so he's come up with something he's supported now for a couple decades, which is this idea that around the edges of a pre-flood supercontinent was cold rock. And the rock was below the crust, a couple hundred miles thick of cold rock, where the rock around it would be, speaking in Fahrenheit, like 3,600 degrees. Then this cold rock would be just 2,900 degrees.
Right. So, big temperature difference.
Yeah. So cold rock.
Cold rock.
And cold rock would be, especially if it's 750 degrees colder, he says, than the hot rock around it, then it's going to be way more dense and it could sink through the hot rock.
Right.
And so that is where he gets the differential to have rocks move on the Earth that God created, that he says triggered the global flood.
Right.
Well, you point out some problems with that.
Right. I will say I see one difference here. This is what I talk about in the article is based on his most recent paper. So now instead of, as he had before, saying that the edges of the continent suddenly cooled and dropped in, now he's saying that that was created that way at creation.
Yes, right.
And then it's stable for 1,600 years or so, and then it starts to plunge below. Right.
So when Dr. Baumgartner said that at the beginning of the flood, God supernaturally chilled all this rock, he cooled it, and people said, well, that's a miracle of convenience. That's an ad hoc rescue device. That just seems peculiar that God froze these rocks to start the flood. I mean, it works in your computer model. It might work. I mean, computer models are notoriously wrong. You know, they could also be very valuable, but they're notoriously wrong also.
Right.
So, but God chilled the edges of a supercontinent. So to get away from that claim that it was a miracle on demand at that moment, John has said now that God created it that way.
God created it that way.
But it gives him another problem.
Well, and so my question is, well, why did that zone of cold rock surrounded by much hotter upper mantle, why did it not begin to sink immediately after creation?
Yes. And the illustration you give a little later is, imagine a marble in a glass of water, and the marble is floating in the glass of water for 1,600 years. It's just floating in the water. It would begin to sink. So he really just changed the miracle, because there'd have to be a miracle to stop it from sinking. That's my way of understanding it.
Right.
He may say, no, there are reasons it would not sink.
Right.
But I don't think he has elucidated those.
Right. I did follow up and he gave me some, you know, some responses. It wasn't real clear to me. But again, I think it's important to understand that this is a model and models can be useful, especially when you're comparing, you know, similar models where you change one or two things. Mm-hmm. But then to just create a model and input the assumptions in order to make it work the way you want the end result to be, I think we just need to understand that that's what we're doing here.
Yeah, right. We take these conditions we want to achieve and we're thinking, okay, what would cause that? And that's perfectly valid to do, but especially when you can independently verify then the initial conditions that you've arrived at.
Some other way, correct. Like right. With climate models, of course, we all know there's problems with climate models, but say you have a climate model and it doesn't work, it doesn't pan out the way you want, well, then you adjust it on what really happened and you can refine and fine-tune it. But here we're talking about something that occurred 4,000 or 5,000 years ago. We have no right. way to calibrate it.
Right. So then there's another problem with CPT. So the one is to initiate it with this super cold zone of rock around the edges of a supercontinent. But then is the question, where did the water come from? And I have heard, I mean, I love these guys. They've reached so many people with the gospel and that God is the creator. And there was a global flood. But I've asked these guys directly, face to face, where did the water come from? And Jane, it seems to me that their answer is so confusing and so non-obvious, and that physics doesn't support their answers in any way, not even remotely, so that they got very poor answers to where did the water come from.
It's not clear to me. I did get a couple different answers. Baumgartner feels that magma coming up from the earth, you know, vaporized seawater, which then exploded into the atmosphere, and that was the fountains of the Great Deep.
He says that the magma from the moving plates hit seawater, and that caused supersonic jets of steam.
Right. It rose through the cracks in the ocean floor, rifts, they call them, and boiled the ocean.
Well, we have magma that spills out into the sea today.
I don't see steam.
No, you don't get supersonic jets of steam. And even if you did, you just have the same amount of water, and you'd be shooting some up into the atmosphere. That's true, if that were to happen. But that doesn't happen.
And magma will just solidify instantly. So even if you got a little burst of steam, you would very quickly create an insulating layer of magma. Now, Baumgartner's response to that was that what we see today is not on the scale that we're talking about.
Sure, it would be. So agreed, you'd have a much greater scale, right? Of course. But that's something you should be able to model, those supersonic jets of steam. I don't believe that's been modeled.
You can do calculations, reportedly. I haven't seen, you know, or know of any, not that they haven't been done. I'm not aware of any that show that.
Right. I'm not either. And then also, and maybe we'll get to this a little later, where did the water come from? But then where did the sediments come from? Because you have to cover the continents with an average of 1 mile deep of sedimentary layers. And the catastrophic plate tectonics model does not generate all that massive quantity of sediments.
No, it doesn't.
Huge problem.
In fact, in his latest paper, John states overtly, which I appreciate him doing that he's basically neglecting 30% of the sediments. He's saying it's clear that there were sediments at creation.
Yes, he seems to be attributing much of the sediments that the whole creation movement, for the most part, has said resulted from the global flood. He wants to put them back before the flood.
Before the flood. So if there's fossils there, I don't know what we,
And then you have the problem of explaining how you would get all those sediments in that short amount of time from creation to the flood.
Exactly. I mean, we're fighting for a young earth, right? So how do you get sediments? So in his model, he's saying that because of the massive tectonic movements, you're creating tsunamis that then flood the earth and erode away portions of the edges of the continents, and that's the source of the sediments.
So, Jane, that's really two things. And I think his paper published in February of this year, 2016, I could be wrong, but I think it's a result of your inquiry in our Real Science Radio Global Flood video.
It could be. And also, there was a very excellent article a while back in CSRQ that challenged the CPT stand on sediments and fossils.
On sediments. So when we've asked, and Fred Williams and I did a show on this, where did the water come from? The whole show on where did the water come from? And we went through the statements of these different flood model proponents, and they don't have water. So John has now published that it was tsunamis from plate tectonics taking the ocean water and throwing it up onto the continents. And then, of course, it would drain off. But he said they were happening so rapidly, they didn't have time to drain off.
Eventually, and it flooded the earth.
Yeah. And I don't believe he could model that either. Two things. I don't believe he could model the supersonic jets being formed from magma. And I don't believe he could model that the continents are going to be covered to above the mountains by tsunamis.
He does have some hydro calculations, some fluid dynamic calculations in his paper, but I don't believe it quantifies the height or the amount of water.
Yes. And I wanted to ask you where this comes from, because he's stating it so explicitly, and I'm so thankful he is. He says the water for flooding the continents is mostly from the original oceans. That's breaking new territory. Where did that come from, that quote?
Dr. Tim Cleary. We traded several emails. That was in an email to me in response to my question, where did the water come from?
So when Fred Williams and I went on the air a year ago, and we stated that these other flood models, they can't come up with additional water, that has been corroborated. Now, Tim Cleary does suggest a way to get additional water from rifts in the crust. Could you explain that?
Sure. He points to research that, very intriguing research, that shows that there are water, or parts of water molecules, rather, embedded within the crystal lattices.
Hydroxide ions,
not free water.
Yes, and so...
And he's saying somehow that was released through heating and found a hydrogen ion to combine with, and that it's sort of like squeezing a sponge.
Yeah.
You got water that way too.
That there's water in the mantle.
Water in the mantle.
So now we're going down into the mantle to get water and somehow squeezing it out of the rocks, but it's not even H2O, like
no,
you said.
No.
This is a hydroxide ion. And even this is very controversial, according to a recent paper in the journal Nature. But let's say it's all there in this mineral matrix at this microscopic level all over throughout the mantle. How do you squeeze it out and concentrate it to get it to come to these rifts and come up to flood the surface of the earth?
And then flow up, right.
Yeah. Yeah.
This, to me, it seems a stretch to try to understand or explain in the CPT scenario what the...
Where did the water come from?
What those storehouses of water were.
And when you read Genesis 6 through 8, like you said, the longest section in the Bible on one specific event, the Bible just very matter-of-factly says, these are the waters of the great deep, as though the reader should know, should understand where the water came from, because just five chapters earlier... In Genesis 1, God says he made the earth. It was covered with the waters of the deep. He emphasizes that. Then he divided the waters below from the waters above with a rakia. And so if the rakia is the crust of the earth, as the Bible shows powerfully, then we know where the waters for the flood came from. They were reserved in storehouses, the Bible describes them, for the time of the flood below the crust.
And the readers, I think, accepted that. For what it said.
Yeah, right. It was the fountains of the great deep. So the CPT model talks about the floors of the oceans, the ocean basins, heating up and rising up about 1.5 kilometers. And so that helps with the water sloshing up, the great tsunamis pushing the water onto the continents because the basins, the floor of the oceans rose up.
Right. So sea level all around the earth, you had more crust of the earth flooded with seawater.
But then within that flood year, they have it cooling down and sinking back down the floors of the oceans.
But there's a problem with that. You can't remove that much heat within a year, not without miraculous intervention.
So again, there has been a change of the model over the last decades, which is great. But some of it is designed to remove reliance on miracles of convenience, but they're just being replaced with more miracles of convenience.
And on the heat problem, Baumgartner is forthright in saying that that is still an issue, and he believes very strongly that God miraculously removed
the heat. And so because CPT, another difficulty with it is that all the heat that would be produced on the surface of the earth would again cook the earth. And so there's the claim that, well, God did a miracle and removed the heat, which is another miracle of convenience, to solve your scientific model's scientific problem. God did miracles, and we affirm that God has intervened in history, but it doesn't seem appropriate to call on miracles of convenience to solve science problems when you're offering a scientific model.
Well, it's not science, and science has its limitations, right? I acknowledge that. I think everybody
sure.
acknowledges that.
Sure.
But when you come up with, as you say, ad hoc miracles that are not anywhere referenced to or alluded to or inferred to in Scripture to solve scientific problems,
right.
that's dangerous territory, and that's what the secular scientists ridicule us for.
What they pointed out. So it's not science, and it's not even good theology when you are invoking miracles not implied in the Bible. And instead of the fountains of the great deep bursting forth, you have the ocean floors rising up.
Ocean floors rising up.
And instead of the fountains of the great deep being water, they're fountains of magma that are somehow squeezing out.
Fountains of magma of the great deep.
Yes, right.
Yes. I would point out that Dr. Baumgartner cites a biblical passage, 2 Peter 3, verses 3 through 6, that alludes to God's intervention in history to judge the world.
Sure, absolutely.
Right. And so he says, well, listen, this proves that God does miracles, and that because it references the flood, that proves that there were miracles during the flood. So yeah. that's the basis of, I recognize there's a heat problem, but we still believe
God did a miracle.
But God did a miracle, and that's validated by this one single passage.
Something we cover in our flood video is that after the flood, there was an ice age. It was a global ice age. And if it were a supernatural event where God intervened to remove the heat, it would be peculiar that he removed too much heat, because then the world suffered through an ice age. So these seem to be just the natural consequences of the events that brought about the global flood, not God intervening and micromanaging and tweaking what's going on during the flood.
Well, that would be my perspective as well.
So then subduction. CPT says you got seafloor spreading, and at the other end of the globe, you've got subduction, where it's diving down into the trenches. So you ask the question, how does subduction start? In both plate tectonics and catastrophic plate tectonics, I think they both admit they can't explain how subduction starts.
In fact, one creation geologist pointed out to me that this is not a problem for CPT, because even secular geologists cannot explain how subduction begins.
Right.
So I'm.
And so you have a slab of the crust of the earth that's maybe 40 miles thick, 60 miles thick, and it has to dive down below another slab that's also 40, 50, 60 miles thick.
But even before that, Bob, you have to take this contiguous, I think all models start with a contiguous continent. First of all, you have to crack it into pieces,
you
right?
You have to crack it.
And then you have to unstick those layers from the adhesion to the underlying.
Because friction.
Friction's huge.
Right. You've got 50 miles thick. I shouldn't keep changing the numbers, but you got 60 miles thick of crust sitting on a mantle. And to start moving that, it's the friction, the overwhelming resistance. How do you overcome that? So with the hydroplate theory, you have water, the subterranean chamber, the waters below the rakia, below the crust, that are lubricating the plates. And that's why they can move.
And not just water, but supercritical water.
Yeah, which is so important.
Almost like frictionless.
Right, supercritical water, and what it does to attack the rock beneath the crust and erode it away. And that's where the sediments come from. As the water comes up from the fountains of the great deep and floods the earth, it's bringing the sediments with it. And it's also bringing the cementing agents with it, because all that rock had to then solidify. And we do need to remember that God designed the earth and the global flood was there as a contingency. And so God knew that when all that sediment would come up to make the surface of the earth stable, it would come up with all the cementing agent, which, and sure enough, science shows us today that rock could harden rapidly within hours, within days and weeks. Literally, rock could harden like limestone or even like marble.
Incredible. And yes, not just material that eroded away between the two layers there above and below that layer of water, but of course also along the sides of the cracks, 60-mile thick, that, you know, carried the cliffs and the boulders and the rocks that went up with it, the fountains of the great deep.
By the way, you quote two secular sources that point out that with plate tectonics, this is the journal Science from 2001, and another journal, Earth and Planetary Science Letters, 2004, and they both admit explicitly, we have no idea how subduction can begin, even though it is so important to our theory, we don't know how it could begin. So like with everything else, with atheist explanations, it begins that way already. Origin of species begins with species. Origin of stars begins with stars.
Correct.
And so on.
Correct. And so, like you say, not only do you have to crack the continents into pieces and unstick them from the mantle below, but then now you've got a 60-mile thick crust or 30 to 60-mile, and you got to somehow offset one piece from the other and then force it to begin diving onto the other. It's hard to come up with a physical mechanism that could do that.
So how would subduction start? The whole world teaches plate tectonics, and the reason it does is because it's an alternative to Genesis. That's why the world accepts plate tectonics. Just like that's why they accept Darwinism, because it's an alternative to God creating us.
Interestingly, though, I had one creation person very active in the young earth creation movement tell me that one of the reasons that Walt Braun's theory is not accepted or not even investigated is because he states very explicitly he doesn't believe in subduction.
Right. Yes. And so a creationist will reject Walt's model because it doesn't support subduction when the entire world, including the creation geologists, cannot explain what would cause subduction to begin. And once it began, how do you continue it?
How do you keep doing it? Yes, and Walt has a very simple one-page, you know, calculation using physics showing you can't do it.
You can't. In fact, we had a show, Subduction Does Not Occur, rsr.org/subduction, based on Walt's work. And the rock, either you're going to push the rock or pull it or some combination. And if you're pushing it, it's going to crush. And if you're pulling it, it's going to split. It's going to break. You can't get subduction, especially realizing that the mantle is more than 99% solid rock. You can't get it.
Right.
So then there's the heat problem that I think we've already discussed. So there's subduction, initiating it, continuing it, the heat problem. Then there's the problem that catastrophic plate tectonics really relies on computer models. And I worked for McDonnell Douglas Helicopter Company back in the 80s in their simulation department for the Apache attack helicopter. So I'm not an expert on simulation, but I know something about it. And you could build models that, for the most part, give you whatever results you're looking for. And it's very common. It happens all the time by the world's leading scientists.
Absolutely. I remember talking to one industrial engineer that I worked with that graduated from an industrial engineering program at the University of Wisconsin. And he often quoted this because we used simple simulations a lot in our work at that time. And this professor was fond of saying all models, all computer models, that is, are bad. Some are useful. Well, and I think that's good to keep in mind.
All computer models are bad. Some are useful. Yeah, that's great. And so you could use John's software, and based on your starting assumptions, you could get the 4 billion year old age of the Earth, or get a global flood, or anything in between.
Or you can get catastrophic plate tectonics when you put in the variables that'll get it to work.
So then you asked Dr. Baumgartner a series of questions that he did not respond to. And this is powerful to me, Jane. You asked John, you appear to set aside sediments that are problematic for your model by stating that they were pre-flood. And Wow. And so then, John, that's a question that was left on the table.
That's a question that was left on the table. He may have an answer for that. I haven't received it yet. But I just, in his latest paper, that really struck me. It was just kind of stated, oh, by the way, we know that there were sediments before the flood. Hmm. That's the first time I had heard that.
Wow. And
because we've been maintaining all along that the sediments are a result of the flood.
The vast majority of the geologic column, there's been history since the flood.
Correct.
6,000 years or so. And there was some brief history, 1,600 years before the flood, but no geologic catastrophes that young earth creationists presumed before the flood. And so that's a dramatic change to the young earth creation model that only exists to save catastrophic plate tectonics.
It appears so, right. So another question that I asked him was that, you know, you have these tsunamis, these great waves flooding the continents from the continental edges. So if that's so, and if the sediments come from eroding the edges of the continents, then it just intuitively, it would seem like you would end up with sort of a bowl with the heavier sediments settling down very close to the edges and fewer sediments then towards the centers of the continents.
So as you go toward the center of a continent, if this model's right and the continents were flooded by tsunamis, then you're going to get the heavier sediments near the edges of the continent. And as you go inland, finer and finer sediments. And so your question is that what we find? And it appears that that's not what we find. Then finally, you ask, John, what are the predictions that CPT has made? And he did not answer that. I'm not aware of any.
I'm not aware of any.
Yes. Whereas you contrast that with, wow, the hydroplate theory and its stunning, Walt's amazing predictions. Fred Williams and I have been making predictions based on the hydroplate theory. And there's just such a high confidence level that we understand the world because you know God's word and you have a rudimentary understanding of science. And so you could sort of predict what we're going to find on asteroids and comets and so on.
But you have to be willing to think outside the box, I guess. And that was one of my conclusions, is hydroplate theory is so different than the secular mindset which CPT is based upon.
Well, I want to thank you, Jane Albright, for writing this series on Noah's flood and contrasting the vapor canopy theory, the hydroplate theory, and catastrophic plate tectonics. And in the conclusion of your series, you look at the controversy. So, Lord willing, we'll do a third show. Would that be all right with you?
That'd be great.
And then we'll look at the controversy and the human dynamics, and we'll see what your recommendations are for both the young earth creation movement and the body of Christ at large. Thank you so much, Jane.
Thank you, Bob.
So this is Bob Enyart for Fred Williams and Real Science Radio. May God bless you.
Intelligent design and DNA. Scholars can't explain it all away. Get ready to be awed by the handiwork of God. Tune into Real Science Radio. Turn up the Real Science Radio. Keeping it real. That's what I'm talking about.